One of the visitors is going to join us as our guest bailiff of the day. But the Chief Justice does not know her name.
I think it is maybe Lexi. Let's see. See what the bailiff says.
Lexi Hilgenkamp. Okay. So welcome, students from Blair High School. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. We always appreciate students coming to watch our oral arguments. And again, Lexi Hilgenkamp from Blair High School has joined us to be a guest bailiff for our last argument, which is entitled State versus Ernest. Mr. Kosmicki, good morning to you. And is it Mr. Adamski?
Yes, sir.
Good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Then, Mr. Kosmicki, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, excuse me, may it please the court, my name is Matt Kosmicki. I represent Mr. Ernest and his direct appeal from a sentence and judgment of the Lancaster County Court convicting him when he was convicted of driving under the influence, causing serious bodily injury and assault, and was sentenced to a term of imprisonment, which collectively was 4 years. Mr. Ernest cites two issues on appeal. One issue is the payment of a $10,000 fine without first determining his ability to pay that fine, and second, that the district court sentence was excessive and ignored factors that would support a more lenient sentence. Starting with the payment of or imposing a $10,000 fine without first determining if he's able to pay that, there's a statute in our, I forget the number, it's in our brief, that if a court imposes a fine on a defendant, the court should determine his ability to pay.
Is that what the statute says?
Well, it says, well, it may, if it imposes a fine where he is to be jailed until it's paid, the court should determine first his ability to pay, is what I believe the statute
says. Do we have that kind of sentence here? Was he ordered to be incarcerated until he paid the fine?
Well, the order is silent on that. And that's the thing that's unclear. An order, a fine is surely a judgment against someone when it's imposed. He could be held in contempt, or a warrant could be issued for his arrest if he doesn't pay it when he's released.
The statute refers to courts or magistrates may make it part of the sentence that the party stand committed and be imprisoned in the jail of the proper county until the fines or costs are paid or secured to be paid, or the offender is otherwise discharged according to law. Did the court make that part of the sentence in this case?
It's not part of the sentence.
So does this statute even apply?
Well, Ernest believes it applies because when a sentence of $10,000 is imposed, it's that big, and he's been in custody as long as he has been, and he's in there, going to be there another 3 or 4 years. Mr. Ernest believes, and I think it's a lot of defendants believe, that not only to satisfy a sentence, do they got to serve the time that's imposed, but they have to satisfy that fine. And Mr. Ernest believes that somehow before he's satisfied or finally satisfied this sentence or this judgment, that he has to satisfy somehow the $10,000 fine.
He believes that the Department of Corrections will continue to detain him after he's served all his time if he doesn't pay the fine.
That's what he believes.
What's that? Is there any statutory authority that that's based on?
There's no statutory authority that says that they'll hold him there. That's just Mr. Ernest believes that before he can gain release, he has to satisfy that fine.
Do you have any authority that supports that?
I don't.
So is this a case that is not yet ripe?
It's probably not yet ripe in some ways. I don't know. It's unclear from the court's order what happens to Mr. earnest if he doesn't pay the fine or has it satisfied when he's done with his sentence. And that's Mr. Ernest's complaint.
Are you familiar with Nebraska Revised Statute 29-2208?
Yes, I am.
Does that have any bearing here?
What's that?
Does that have any bearing here?
That he could ask for a hearing on that, right? That's what you're referring to. I have. Right. Yeah. He could ask for that at some point and ask. Nebraska statutes do allow him to ask for a hearing if he's unable to pay a fine and then determine whether he can pay it, do it in installments, or forgive it. Yes, he could.
And would such a hearing or an order following such a hearing be a final appealable order?
Yes, it would be.
So that takes us back to the ripeness argument.
Right.
Okay.
Do you have a separate objection to the manner of the sentence in terms of consecutive?
I do. Well, it's part of my excessive sentence, but yes, I added that in. Is that the district court, I think that it's examples of the district court's, for lack of a better word, intent to sentence him excessively. The district court, in its statement at sentencing, stated that because it's separate and distinct, there was required to run the sentences consecutive to one another. Neither statute states that it has to be run consecutive.
The statutes don't require it, but the statutes do permit consecutive.
They do permit.
Is that correct?
And that's what, yeah. And like we said in our brief, the court may do that, right? But it isn't like this statute is like use of a weapon to commit a felony where it says separate and distinct and must be mandatory consecutive.
I believe the state concedes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. I believe the state concedes that point.
Right.
But they argue that there's really no doubt what the district court's intent was based on the statement, I will keep you away from the community for as long as I can. And so as I understand the argument, their argument is even if the district court was wrong on whether the sentences had to be consecutive or not, same result would follow. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is that's just, I mean, we don't know what, obviously the district court was wrong that it was required to run a consecutive, and so I think that we don't really can ever tell what the district court's intent was. Was it to make it consecutive? I don't think that statement is an equivocal.
You think there's a chance on remand the district court will do something different?
Well, I don't know what the judge would do. Because she was mistaken on the law. And not only is it just the mistaken on the mandatory consecutive, but also on the imposition that she had to suspend his license for 15 years without ignition interlock. There's nothing in that statute that says that you have to suspend someone and not authorize ignition interlock.
So are you asking for a remand back for resentencing? Are you asking us to modify the sentence? And if it's remanded back, does it go back to the same judge or to a different judge?
Well, I prefer that you modify it here. But if that's my first choice, and if the court doesn't feel that it can modify it here, then remand it to the district court for sentencing.
The same district judge?
The same district judge. Because she's the one who sat through the case and heard the facts at the plea and read the PSI. Yes. Also, I guess to finish off that thought is that the district court also abused its discretion by opposing an excessive sentence, failing to recognize statutory factors in favor of a more lenient sentence. You know, he was successful on probation before. He has a minimal criminal history. He's been successful in treatment in the past. But the more important theme in his PSI is the mental health issues from that auto accident that he had and the physical disabilities that he had from that. It was determined in the probation report that he needed mental health treatment for that. I think it was depression that he was suffering from. He has no use of one of his arms. He has to have he has rods inserted in that. He has hard difficulty walking.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with all the facts, but did this event occur while he was on bond in another case, or was it
vice versa? I can't hear you.
What did this case occur when he was on bond from another case, or was he on bond from this case when another case
occurred? He was on bond on this case when that second case happened.
And that second case was a charge of driving under the influence?
And operating a vehicle to avoid arrest. Yep.
Does that give any pause to the trial court?
It may have. I don't know.
The court's ordered him not, I'm assuming, not to drink as a condition of bond or
right.
not to violate the
right.
law. And,
right.
and there's allegations that he did, in fact, do that.
Correct.
Does that cut against his ability to follow court orders and be on probation?
It's certainly evidence of it, yes. Sentencing has a couple principles. I know you know this. You've heard it and read it multiple times. There's principles of, you know, punishment, accountability, protection of the public, but there's also the rehabilitation part. And clearly Mr. Ernest is in need of rehabilitation. He needed to deal with his mental health from the accident and the physical impairment that he had from it, and treatment.
And the court acknowledged that. Didn't the judge say, I'm not sure why you aren't taking advantage of treatment, but I hope that you will, or something to that effect?
Well, she said that, but what he had done is had been to Mission Fields. That was part of the PSI. That he did that. I don't know if it's that got in there. I know this, so I'm going to say it. He left that to come to treatment here in Lincoln. I don't know if that got in there. I wasn't his trial counsel. I don't remember as long enough. But he was coming here for inpatient treatment in a place he'd been here before. He had been successful at Pine Lake Behavioral Health in the past, and that's my understanding is he was coming here. So he was making attempts at treatment, and we all know that, you know, people aren't successful in treatment until they hit rock bottom. And I think that's where Mr. Ernest was at this point. So, granted that there were things that didn't, like the subsequent bond violation, which ended up his bond being revoked and he was incarcerated until he went to prison, there are other factors. And like I said, the rehabilitative needs are important for Mr. Ernest, because at some point he's going to be released back into society. And it's important at this critical juncture that the judicial system jumps in and helps him with that, and could have done it with probation and the subsequent treatment with that. I see my time's up, so ask for a relief as we prayed in our brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Mr. Adamski, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Paul Adamski for the state. Ernest complains that the district court erred by not considering his ability to pay a fine before it issued the $10,000 and $1,000 fine in this case. As this court has kind of noted, 2206 only requires that the court consider a defendant's ability to pay the fine if the court orders that the defendant stand committed until that fine is paid. The court did not order that. The order is silent, which would mean that the court did not order that to be the case. If Ernest is unable to pay this fine, he has multiple avenues of relief. Under 2208, he can petition the court to make a showing of his ability to pay the fine. Also, there is 2412, under which if he is arrested later for his failure to pay the fine, he is also entitled to a hearing to show his ability to pay that fine.
And if the court were not to grant his relief, would he have the ability to appeal from that decision?
I don't know, but I would imagine so, that would be a factual finding that the court made that could be appealed. Ernest also complains about...
When is he obligated, if the sentencing order is silent on when the fine has to be paid, when is he obligated to pay it?
I'm not clear on that, Your Honor. 2408 says that it is the clerk's office who is authorized to execute on fines and costs. And so I believe it would be the clerk's office's discretion as to when they will collect on that fine. So
it could be levied on by execution in the ordinary process that would be used in a civil judgment.
I'm unaware, but I would imagine so. Ernest also complains about the sentence, that the court abused its discretion. He first talked about that the court mistakenly believed it was required to impose the sentence as consecutive. As the state conceded in the brief, the court was mistaken on that. The court had the permission to impose these sentences consecutively, but was not required to. However, it's clear from the record that the court would have imposed these sentences consecutively regardless. First of all, the court stated that its intention was to keep Ernest away from the community as long as possible. It accordingly imposed sentences to the statutory limit on both counts. as well as revoked his license for 15 years, which was also the maximum there. The court also, if it believed that consecutive sentences were too harsh for Ernest, given the nature of his crime, it could have, despite its mistaken belief about it needing to impose these sentences consecutively, it could have imposed a lesser sentence, since it imposed these sentences at the statutory limits, but it chose not to. So it would be unnecessary to remand this case for resentencing on those issues. Ernest also complains about the court's imposition of a 15-year license revocation with no opportunity for an ignition interlock, but the record also shows there that the court was not under any mistaken belief, but rather that it was exercising its authority to impose, again, maximum punishment on those counts.
Could the court have ordered interlock device after a period of time on the 15-year license revocation?
Your Honor, that's a difficult question. My best answer is I don't think so. So it's sort of a lengthy argument. This court in 2017 in State v. Irish noted that for DUI with serious bodily injury, a defendant is not eligible for an ignition interlock. The legislature in 2019 did pass an amendment to a different statute, and it was the legislature's explicit intent to allow for an ignition interlock to a defendant convicted of DUI with SBI. If you look at the statement of intent for this bill, it says that quite plainly. However, I'm not convinced that the legislature affected its intent there. So for instance, the only statutory reliance that Ernest relies on is 60-4118.06, subsection 3A, where it says that an ignition interlock shall not be issued unless the defendant has been convicted of a series of offenses that includes this one. So which is to say that this subsection says that a defendant is not prohibited from an ignition interlock, but that's not the same as authorizing a court to issue an ignition interlock. And I have perhaps a more stronger argument, which is that when you look at the DUI with SBI statute, it says that the court will order the person not to drive any motor vehicle for any purpose for a period of time of at least 60 days and not more than 15 years, and that this is also coextensive with the license revocation. So there's two parts. There's the license revocation, and there's the order not to drive any motor vehicle. Now, ordinarily, if you just have your license revoked, you may be eligible for an ignition interlock. But when you look at the other DUI statutes, there is language about how a court may order you not to drive for 45 days, after which, even though your license is still revoked, you may apply for an ignition interlock, which would imply that the no driving order is inconsistent with receiving an ignition interlock. And since the DUI with SBI statute says that it's coextensive, the license revocation, which in this case was ordered to be 15 years, there's also a coextensive 15-year prohibition from driving for any purpose. To me, that would suggest that this defendant is not entitled to an ignition interlock.
Ever?
During that 15-year period. Okay. That's my understanding. I'm not 100% confident, but that's my best understanding. I haven't been able to find any other statutory authorization that would allow for a defendant under 6198, the DUI with SBI statute, to receive an ignition interlock. You know, if you look at the statute that Ernest cites, 4118.06, you know, he cites that subsection of 3A, which was modified in 2019. But if you look at the first subsection, 1, which seems to describe the conditions under which an ignition interlock can be acquired, you know, it gives three different options. There's a court order under 6211.05, or an order under 6197.03, or an order from the Board of Pardons. When you look through these statutes, all of these apply to 6197 DUI and 6190, well, it wouldn't be, I don't think it would be 98, but it would be the refusal statute, which is not the DUI with SBI statute, it's a different, separate statute. So again, I don't find any authority for a DUI with SBI defendant to receive an ignition interlock, but I'm 100% confident again. If this court has no other questions, I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Thank you very much. That then concludes arguments in State versus Ernest, which is the last case of the day. Counsel, you are excused, and the court is adjourned, but